Hey, I didn't say I was smart, okay? So, third time's a charm, yes? Of course it is. And don't start sending me hate mail for being a dope, okay? Stand by. Target.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. I'm friends with...
Yeah. The third time was a charm. All right, so what you're about to hear is probably one of the most unique interviews I've ever done about a Marine Corps career, because it is it's about Jim Bathurst. Refers to himself as Sergeant B. Rose from the rank of private to gunnery sergeant, and then was given a commission, one of between 4,000 and 5,000 staff NCOs that was commissioned during the Vietnam War. And he's a communicator, and didn't want to be. He doesn't have a good experience as a communicator, and he wants to be a grunt because the guys he meets in the grunts are good dudes. And the story of how he gets to the grunts is pretty interesting. And but he's just an interesting career. The professional staff NCOs he met, how they raised him, the lessons they taught him are pretty amazing. His experience in Vietnam is amazing. You'll hear about that. And just all the different people that opened doors for him because he could lead and they saw it. You know, not everybody's career happens like Bathurst's career, but he certainly made an impression on people. And people don't open doors in the Marine Corps without, you know, you performing to have those doors open for you. And I never saw him, never served with him, but when you hear his story, there's no doubt in your mind that he must have been a hell of a leader because of all the different doors that people opened for him and shoved him through and say, hey, go do your thing. So you're going to meet him. And ultimately, after he retires, he's written a book, and you'll hear about that, entitled We All Die as Marines, if I'm not mistaken. And you can Google up Jim, J-I-M, Bathurst, B-A-T-H-U-R-S-T. Okay. And he also has a blog. You can find that too. Not very difficult. So, it started out to be an hour interview. I've been bugging him, I don't know, probably for close to a year. And, along with a couple other people that know him. And he's also very busy, though. Something that he loves now that fills his life is a program called the Young Marines. So he's going to come back on that, and we're going to talk about the Young Marines. So Jim Bathurst, in his own words, on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue here on a Monday, and as advertised, this interview has been a long time in the making, just so everybody knows it. And I've heard about Jim Bathurst throughout my career and heard nothing but good things, and we're privileged to be joined by him today. So first of all, Jim, welcome to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate this.
All right.
Contrary to popular belief, I am kind of a humble guy. so don't ask me to brag about myself.
You know what? I was when I was a kid, my grandmother had a Gaelic term for me that was called Gosh Gia, which is one who has a high opinion of himself. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, right? There's nothing wrong.
Well, the Marine Corps,
Exactly. Right? Yeah. And since nobody else is going to tell me I'm any good, then I better believe it myself or I'm in trouble.
That's right.
All right.
I mean, that's part of being a Marine. You got to have an ego that, you know, you got to turn sideways to walk in a door. You know, some of them let their ego drive everything they do, and, you know, but, you know, at some point in time, they all reach their terminal rank. So we don't worry about them too much.
Not too much. Let's, first of all, before we get talking about different issues and things like that, we need to learn about you for people that don't know you. Born and raised where?
I was born and raised along the shores of the land of Pleasant Living. If you're not an East Coast guy, you don't remember that, but back in my day, the National Bohemian Brewery in Baltimore was the every, if you were from Maryland and you didn't drink National Bo, the one-eyed guy, you were an outcast. And their advertisement was brewed on the shores of the Chesapeake Bay, the land of pleasant living. Well, that's where I was brewed. I grew up on the shores of the Chesapeake Bay. My parents are originally from Pennsylvania. My dad, with 50 cents in his pocket, came down to hitchhike down to Baltimore and got a job working for Bethlehem Steel. He was a welder. And then when he got settled, a year or so later, he moved to Mom, and Mom was pregnant with me when they came down from Pennsylvania. They're from originally from Altoona. So that's where I grew up. I mean, I can't think of a better place in the world to grow up in, you know, boating, crabbing, fishing, trap muskrats, during the winter to raise some money for myself. Just a great place to live. I mean, it summer was king, you know. I mean, we lived right on the water, so, you know, we had a boat. You know, not much of a boat, just a rowboat to start with. But,
right.
Hold on.
There's a lot of jokes that get made about people and muskrats. So I want you to footnote that. What did you do with the muskrats? Did you skin them for their pelts?
Well, I got a great story.
Did you skin them for their pelts? Did you eat them?
Yeah. No, I skinned them. A guy by the name of Jimmy Logan, who was about 4 years older than me, graduated from high school and was going to get out of the business, so he sold me the traps, and my dad knew a little bit about trapping, not particularly muskrats. I don't know what he trapped as a kid up in Pennsylvania, but I started it, and Jimmy had shown me how to skin them, and you skin them, and you got to have the nose and the ears and the nose whiskers and everything else on the hide. And you turn them, you wash them off real good. There can be no meat on the skin.
Okay.
And then you turn them inside out and put them on a spreader. And my dad, being a welder and a guy, he made these metal. He took metal rods and bent them appropriately, so you could squeeze the end of the rods together, slide it inside the muskrat inside out, and then let it go, and it would spring out. And then you hung them up and dried, and when they dried, I sent them to a place called Keystone Hide Company in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And depending on the size, what have you, you know, I get, back in those days, I might get 75 cents. If it was a large one, then it was in good shape. I'd get $1 for them. It was a lot of work. I mean, I had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning on school days and go run my trap line. Come back and then go to school and then come home from school and go run the trap line again. If you had one live in there, you didn't want him to chew his leg off and leave. But anyway, one day I'm down skinning a couple of rats and my dad come down and said, we were hunters, Dad and I. We were big hunters then. And we always had in the freezer, we always had rabbits, squirrels, venison in the freezer. And my dad, says, do you ever get one live? And I said, oh, yeah. He said, well, the next time you get one live, he said, mark it and let me know when you get home. So anyway, I did. I caught one live several days later where I had to kill it. So I came home, and he was already home from work, and I went up and said, I got one alive. So he came down, so he skinned that one, and I was skinning another one. And then he goes over to the sink, and he washes the muskrat off, and he starts, you know, quartering it, cutting the legs and everything. So I walked over and I watched him, and I said, what are you doing? He said, shut up. I said, okay. So he cleans this all off, and so he wraps it in freezer paper when he's all done, and then he takes a pen and he marks on it squirrels and puts an X on it. And, you know, I didn't think much about it. I thought, what the heck's he, what's he doing? So, you know, we always eat in games, see? So
right.
We're mom's fixing dinner one night, and he happens to look at the wrapper laying on the thing. I found this out later, and it had an X on it. So we're sitting down, we're eating this squirrel. And, so, you know, just him and I and mom, my sister is 8 years older than me, had already, you know, left and was married to a Marine, of course. And so he asked my mother, he said, what do you think of these squirrels? She said, well, they're really good. She said, they don't taste like the other squirrels. They got kind of a good taste to them. And I looked over at my dad, and he, you know, gave me the shh. So that's what happened. From then on, every time I had one live, I would, I would bring it home, skin it, take it over to the sink and in the basement, wash it off and everything else, and put it in the freezer. And I wouldn't put an X on it. I'd just write squirrels. So we ate them. And my mother, to the day she died, never knew she ate a muskrat. And they really are good. I mean, the people down, you know, I mean, they're, you know, they're a rat, and they got a ratty tail, and that, of course, turns everybody off, you know. But they're a bit, what they eat is roots. I mean, they don't eat meat. You know, there's nothing wrong with them. I mean, they live in a swamp.
So
they're a very clean animal.
So you'd recommend them as a culinary choice, muskrats? Like,
oh, I would.
Got a bad name?
I would, absolutely. I would. I mean, because, you know, when I was eating it, I kind of suspected it was a muskrat the first time.
Why?
So I was really kind of hesitant about it, you know. But when I bit into it and tasted it, I thought to myself, holy cow, this ain't bad, you know. So we ate a lot of muskrats. If my mother would have ever known that, she'd have killed me.
Somebody's gonna account for that someplace on Judgment Day.
Oh yeah, she'd roll over the grave to do that.
That's all. So how does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Well, can you imagine a 14-year-old? Like I said, sis is 8 years older than I am. She's still kicking. I'm 77, and she's 85.
Okay, so 77, you're born in 1940.
40, yeah. Okay. And can you imagine being about a, you know, 13, 14-year-old kid, or maybe 12? Yeah, probably 12, or maybe even less. Somebody coming over to the house to pick up your sister on a date wearing dress blues.
Yeah, that's impressive.
You know, I mean, I looked at that and said, wow.
What's that?
Man, that's sharp. I better give me a set of them. You know? And the summer months. Go ahead.
How do I get those clothes? It's a uniform, son.
Yeah.
You gotta
yeah.
be a Marine.
And, so he was a reserve. And I never knew this. And I've said this to people and they've argued with me and said, no, the Marine Corps would never do that. He was in a senior year of high school, and there was a reserve unit in Baltimore, and that's what he belonged to. And that reserve unit got activated to Korea, and he went. They yanked his butt out of high school, and that whole unit went to Korea. And when I told that story to people, they said, no, the Marine Corps would never take a guy out of high school. I said, well, they did my brother-in-law, and he was at the reservoir. But you know, he'd come over to the house and also in my teen years, 13, 14, after they got married, I would go spend a week or two with them during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I was to Indian Head, Maryland when he was going through EOD school. I was at Quantico, Virginia when he was stationed at the ammo dump at Quantico.
Nice.
I was at Camp Lejeune with him one time.
Wait a minute. Why don't you say Lejeune? That's how General Lejeune.
Oh, it is Lejeune. You're right. It is Lejeune. And I get, you know, I get castigated a lot for not calling it Lejeune.
No, I used to call it Lejeune too, and then I heard an interview with his daughter saying, well, it's Lejeune. And that's how we pronounce it. And then once you know they're from Louisiana, then it all makes sense, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because
they don't speak English
in Louisiana anyway, so whatever.
No, they don't.
I'm okay with that. So, anyway.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so
but anyway, that was my introduction. And I saw, you know, I saw Battle Cry. You know, I just loved that movie. And, of course, there's an interesting continuation of that. And, you know, because that, in Battle Cry, that's about the 2nd Battalion of 6th Marines.
Why did they make it a comm unit?
Why'd they make it a what?
Well, isn't in the movie, isn't the commanding officer, what's his nickname, High Pockets in Battle Cry?
Yeah, High Pockets.
Huxley, but isn't it, aren't they a communications unit?
No, it's an infantry battalion. But
the
kid that the story is about is a communicator.
Oh,
but it's 2nd Battalion, 6th Marines.
All right.
And Huxley had this thing that they never rode anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
They always humped. They always walked. And lo and behold, when I became a lieutenant colonel, graduated from the Naval War College and came down, got orders to Lejeune, and lo and behold, when it, my name came up to get a battalion, it was a 2nd Battalion of 6th Marines. So, you know, I was a member of Huxley's whores. that's what they called them in the book, but in the movie they call them Huxley's harlots because they didn't use that term.
You can't use whores back in a movie, for God's sake.
So you have
Marine Corps dripping all over you. When do you enlist and what do you become?
Well, you know, I was okay in school through elementary and, you know, when I went to school, it was 1 through 6 elementary, 7 through 9 junior, and 10 through 12 senior. And I was okay through junior high school. I mean, I played the drums. I played in the band. I was a cross country star. I mean, I was their number two guy on the team, cross country wise. I was very involved.
Right.
But then I got bussed to Dundalk High School, about 6 miles away from where I lived. And all the kids that went to Dundalk High School, most of them were from Dundalk. And I didn't live in Dundalk. I lived in a town, in a community called Inverness. So we were, I can assume this is, I guess I experienced some of what the kids experienced later, much later in our country, where we were busing kids all over the place.
Yeah.
And I started hanging around with a different crowd. And the next thing you know, I went to hell in a handbasket. By the time I reached the 11th grade, I despised school. I hated it. I mean, I dreaded getting up in the morning and going to school. I didn't like anything about it at all. And it finally, when I turned 17 in December of 1957, you know, it was obvious to me when the report cards came out that I wasn't going to graduate. I think I had one C, all the rest were D's, and some couple E's. And I pleaded with my parents to sign for me to join the Marine Corps, and they wouldn't do it. I had to finish school. So I went back to school after the Christmas, New Year's holiday of 57, 58. And, it went to hell in a handbasket. It got worse and worse and worse, and I just couldn't stand it anymore. So I just kept hounding my parents and saying, you know. So I always say that I got out before the report cards. I was supposed to graduate in May of 58. They finally, my dad said, okay, look, I'll let you, this is in March. He said, I'll let you quit school. But it was known I was going to join the Marine Corps. And he said, but you'll go join the Marine Corps as soon as you quit school. And the plan was that I would quit school. I'd hang around for summer because summer is king on the Chesapeake Bay. And have some fun in the summer, and then I could join the Marine Corps, you know, in the fall. And he said, no. He said, I'll sign for you to join, but the day you quit school, you'll walk into a Marine recruiter's office and join the Marine Corps. And I went, whoa. I don't know whether I'm ready for that or not. So I had the okay, but I just thought, well, I'll just keep trying, you know, I'll keep going. Well, it got worse. There was one teacher I couldn't stand. I hated the guy. And he and I got in a tip one day in class. He made some snide comment to me, and I made a snide comment back to him. And he sent me to the office. And, you know, I had to go listen to the vice principal give me his lecture again, you know, that he's done 11 times before. And,
just for clarity, when you say TIFF, did the TIFF involve your hands, or was it simply a discussion?
Oh no, it was no hands. It was a shouting match is what it was.
Okay. All right.
I would never have done anything like that. So I went home and at the dinner table that night I said, okay, I'm ready. So I already had the papers. I'd had them for months. So they signed the papers, and I went into school the next morning, turned them in to the principal, went around, got my grades from all the teachers I had. And that afternoon, I had my own car then, and I drove down to the Baltimore recruiting place and walked in there, and what rank? I think he was a sergeant. He said, what are you doing here, son? And I said, I want to join the Marine Corps. He said, how old are you? I said, 17. He said, why aren't you in school? And I proudly announced that I just quit. And he said, you shouldn't do that. Go back to school and come and see me when you graduate. And I said, no. I said, because I won't graduate. The only way Dundalk High School would let me walk across the street is to maybe sweep it down after everybody left. So if you won't let me join, I'll go find another recruiter station. So anyway, I joined. And a couple of days later, I had the physical and everything else, and I shipped out to Parris Island. And I joined on March 6th, 1958, as a high school dropout. Couldn't do that today.
Right.
Because they're not taking high school dropouts. So that's how I wound up in the Corps. Went to boot camp, left there, went to Geiger, to ITR, left ITR, got stationed at Quantico. My MOS was originally a basic 2500, communications. And I went to Comm Company, SDT, Quantico, Virginia, who are the demonstration troops for the candidates at OCS and at the basic school.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated it. I really hated it. I had a bunch of NCOs that weren't worth a hoot. I really hated Quantico. And they were going to make me a wireman, a 2511, and we went out the field one day, and I saw a guy gaff out of a 40-foot pine tree and hit every limb on his way down, two broken legs and a broken arm, and I thought, I don't think I want to be a wireman. So a couple days later, the comm chief at formation said that we need some people for backpack radio. And I shot my hand in the air, so I transferred over and became a 2531, a field radio operator. But I still hated the place. I mean, I really hated it. The NCOs were just, they were awful. They were really awful.
Jim, let me ask you a question. Did you know they were awful, or did you just think that was the Marine Corps?
No. Well, I knew they were awful because I had my three DIs, Sergeant Bresnahan, Sergeant Hanschemacher, and Sergeant Collins, there was a Staff Sergeant E5 and two Sergeants E4. and they set the example for me. ITR was horrible. They had corporals and sergeants there, and they were horrible. I mean, you kind of set the gauge, you know, the bar is set with your drill instructors.
Right.
And these guys, they didn't care about us fledglings, you know, us snuffies. They didn't care about us. There was just no leadership whatsoever. Now, at the gunny level, the radio chief and the comm chief and the wire chief, they were staff NCOs, all Korean veterans.
Right.
Let me stop you. What was the Marine Corps like? That's many, many sunsets in the rearview mirror. What was it like? You're born in 1940. You grew up in the shadow of World War II and then Korea. I would dare say everybody that in your neighborhood served in World War II in some capacity with exceptions. Your teachers, your coaches, you know, your world is filled with those veterans. And what was the Marine Corps like with all those guys who'd fought in World War II and all those guys who'd fought in Korea? What was that like?
Well, the senior guys, you know, the guys that were from the WW2 were great. But, you know, as a young private PFC, you don't get to see much of them. What you see is where the rubber meets the road, the corporals and the sergeants. And in the comm field, it was horrible. I mean, they weren't leaders. They were arrogant. They were very authoritative. What do you want?
Right.
You know, that kind of attitude. I didn't go to comm school. You know, usually they went to, you went to comm school out in Imperial Beach, California. I didn't go to comm school. I mean, when I joined the backpack radio unit, you know, we had PRC 8, 9s, and 10s back in those days, and it was my fellow Marine privates and PFCs that taught me how to use a radio, and taught me everything I knew about a radio. I didn't go to any kind of a school. It was all OJT. And it was my peers that taught me. It wasn't the NCOs. They didn't have any respect for us or anything else. And, you know, I got there late 58, and in the summer of 59, the Leatherneck magazine always has a post at the Corps.
Right.
I don't know whether they still do, but they did back then. And I remember in June or July of 59, the post of the Corps was Marine Barracks, Yokosuka, Japan. And boy, I must have read that article, you know, a dozen times. And I thought, boy, that looks like a good place to serve. So, one day at formation, the first sergeant says, we've got some quotas in for some Marine barracks overseas. If you're interested, come see me. I went right into his office. And there were about 10 of us there. So he called us in and interviewed us. And he said, I got a couple openings for Marine Barracks, Subic Bay, Philippines. And I said, I'll take it. Any Marine barracks, get me out of this place. So that's what I got orders to. Went home on 30 days leave, flew to Treasure Island, California. Embarkation, debarkation, that's where people came and went. You went by ship, you didn't fly. One side of the barracks was debarkation, that's people coming back from overseas, and then on my side was embarkation, people going overseas. I spent about 30 days there and waiting for my ship to come in. One day at formation, the gunny, says the following people fall out and fall in over here. And of course he's alphabetical and I'm like number one. And so I said, oh good, it's time. Fly over and he said, and I look around at the people that that are standing in this group, and I don't recognize any. I mean, I have a set of orders that's got like 15 people on it going to Marine Barracks Subic Bay, and I don't recognize any of these people. So when it was all done, you know, I'm a PFC now, and so when he tells us, you know, you're going to get, you know, he had a corporal there, Corporal so-and-so, you take charge of these Marines, you march them to Chow, early Chow, get back here, have side with our seat bags at 1300. So I go up to the gunny, and I said, gunny, where am I going? Well, you know, after he berates me for 30 minutes as being a dumb shit, you don't know where you're going. You came here with orders, and you don't know where you're going. So I just stood there. And he says, and he looks down at the list, and he says, you're going to Marine Barracks, Yokosuka, Japan. I went, wow. So I didn't say a word. So we got on the USNS Wiggle, and we sailed across the Pacific Ocean, and I got off and went to Marine Barracks, Yokosuka, Japan. The day we're checking in, there's about 10 of us, and the day we're checking in, and we have to go see the personnel officer, and so they call people's names out, and it seemed to be going alphabetical, but they're not calling me. So finally, I'm sitting on the bench in the personnel office by myself, and the gunny comes, says, you haven't gone in and seen the captain yet? And I said, no, sir. So he leaves, and he comes back. He said, all right, here, go see the captain. So I went in and reported to the captain, and he tells me to stand at ease, and he said, I don't know why, but we don't have your record book. I said, sir, I have an idea where it's at. He says, where's that? I said, it's probably at Marine Barracks, Subic Bay. He goes, what? So I tell him the story. And he said, well, son, we got you now. You're staying here. So I spent 2 years at Marine Barracks, Yokosuka, Japan, and that's where I saw leadership. That's what changed my whole attitude towards the Marine Corps, is Marine Barracks, Yokosuka, Japan. I was in port security section, and the gunnery sergeant, God, I can close my eyes and picture him. His name was Gunnery Sergeant J.C. LaPlace. And he used to walk in the squad bay, and there was this kid by the name of Private Hall. Hall had been a private PFC I don't know how many times. He was a good Marine, but don't turn him loose on liberty. And the gunny would snap his fingers, and Hall would slide his footlocker out to the center of the squad bay, and the gunny would step up on the footlocker and say, all right, gather around here. God's got some scoop for you. And, you know, we'd all chuckle and laugh. And one day, sitting around talking to Hall, because I was in the same cubicle with him, and we got talking about Gunny LaPlace, and I told him, you know, how, you know, I said, I really respect that guy. I mean, he goes, well, you know what JC stands for, don't you? And I said, no. He said, Jesus Christ. He is God. and that, you know, and then I was, you know, my goal was to be a gate sentry. I mean, they were the numero unos. You know, I started out on post 9 and 1 through 4 were the gate sentries. And I finally make it to the gate. And I'm on the gate for, you know, a couple weeks, and all of a sudden I Captain Reed, who was the guard officer, I get off post at 4 o'clock, 1600 one afternoon, and the word is that Captain Reed wants to see me. And I go report to Captain Reed, and he says, you're going to the brig. And my asshole fell out, and he said, and he realized how I had taken that, and he laughed and said, no, I mean, you're being transferred to the brig section. And they were God in our barracks.
The brig?
When you went to the brig section, you were hot stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Because that's tough work. People will tell you that's not easy mentally. That's tough work.
No, it wasn't. But, you know, they didn't wear the uniform of the day. They wore utilities with a black leather belt. That was our uniform of the day. And, I got transferred to the brig, and the brig warden was a guy by the name of Gunnery Sergeant Alton A. Cobb, another role model to follow. And we had 3 sergeants as our duty wardens, and they were all superb sergeants. You know, my section leader was Corporal Lebo, Bilo, and he was a great corporal. You know, I mean, they really cared about us. They really, and, you know, and I eventually made Lance Corporal, then I eventually made Corporal, and I took over the Fort Security section. And, you know, by then I was a career Marine. I mean, I'd seen the Marine Corps. I'd seen, you know, what leadership was all about, and I just had some great role models. I mean, I'll tell you a story about Sergeant Lejeune. That was really his name, Sergeant Lejeune. I was on post 8 and 9. We're on the long defense line next to Uragi Docks, Japanese shipbuilding company.
Got it.
And post eight had one end, and post 9 had the other end, and there was a fence between them with an open gate. And I'm walking post, and there's a street light at the gate separating the two posts. And the only way you could get into my post is to come through the other post. So I walk down, and every time I walk down there, I see Hall sitting on a chair smoking. And I smoked the rest of the time. So I go down the hall, and he'd go, "Hey, Bathurst." He was kind of had a Mexican accent. And I said, "Hey, Bathurst, you want a cigarette?" I said, "No, you're not supposed to be smoking on post." "Ah, don't ever catch me." So, you know, walk my post. I'm on there for 4 hours. That's a 3-hour mark. You know, I'm really dying for a cigarette. So I walk down there and I say, "Hall, give me a cigarette." So give me a cigarette, two matches, and a piece of the striker off of his book matches. See? So I walk up the other end of the building, and I look back down towards Hall, and Hall's gone. He's not sitting there anymore. So I get the cigarette out, you know, and I get this little piece of striker, and I get this match, and I peek back around the corner again to make sure, you know, nobody's come, because that's the only way they can get to my post.
Right.
And all of a sudden, you know, so I strike the match, and shit, it's real bright, so, you know, and I burn myself, I drop it, so I got one match left. So I look around the corner again to make sure nobody's coming, and it's about 150 yards down to that gate. So I get it out, I strike the match, and I just bring it up to my mouth, and somebody blows it out. I turn around, and there's Sergeant Lejeune, the Sergeant of Guard. And I'm thinking, how in the hell did he get this stuff? He must have climbed the damn fence. You know? So he goes, "Report your post, Marine." So I drop everything, you know, and I report my post. And he says, "You know you're not supposed to be smoking on post." I said, "Yes, sir. Come and see me when you get off duty." And I had the 8 to 12.
Ooh.
So I get off post at midnight, and I go in and turn in my pistol and everything else at the corporal, the guard's desk. And I said, "I think Sergeant Lejeune wants to see me, but he's probably asleep." He goes, "Oh, no, he's in there waiting for you. Just knock on the hatch." So I knocked on the hatch, went in, and all he had on was his green trousers and a T-shirt. So he sat me down, and he said, "Why were you smoking on post?" So, you know, I didn't want to get Hall in trouble, but I basically told him the story and everything else, and everybody knew what Hall was like. And he said, "But you knew you were doing wrong." I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Did you learn anything from this?" And I said, "Absolutely." "And what did you learn?" I said, "I will obey my 11 general orders every time I go on post from now on. I learned." He said, "Well, I think the pistol locker has a lot of pistols that need to be cleaned. So when Liberty Call goes this afternoon at 16:30, you know anybody that can come and clean those pistols?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Good." And that was it. He never told my corporal the guard about it. He never told Gunny the place about it. He didn't tell anybody. I mean, that's leadership to me. And I did. 16:30, Liberty Call went. I went down and I cleaned every damn one of those pistols in that pistol locker. It took me to about 10 o'clock at night. But see, that's the kind of leadership I experienced once I got away from comm company. So by the time I left Marine Barracks Yokosuka, Japan in October 1961, I had 5 months left to do in the Marine Corps, and I was, you know, I'd already made up my mind I was going to reenlist for 6 years and stay. because I finally experienced what later, and I had such good mentors that, that it just, you know, I mean, it changed everything. Had I stayed at Quantico, I'd have probably gotten in trouble.
So I never
stayed in a Marine Corps.
At Yokosuka, as a corporal, how old are you, 21, 22? No, you're older than that.
No, I was, which was the other strange thing. You had to be 21 to work in a brig. I wasn't 21. I was 19 when they transferred me to the brig. The brig system was just now changing from brigs to correctional facilities. We were the last red line brig in the Far East.
Explain it to me.
We had red lines painted on the deck, and they were all numbered. And except during shower time at night, when the prisoners were showering, they had to request permission to cross the red line. That's how you controlled them. I mean, we had the whole gamut. You know, we had murderers that had gotten a general court martial and a BCD and time in Leavenworth and everything else. But they stayed with us until a trial goes to the convening authority, and then it goes to a supervisory authority.
Right.
And they stayed with us until the supervisory authority approved the sentence, and then they were shipped out of the states. It was a 100-man brig, and we usually had about anywhere from, well, we've been as low as in the 60s, but, you know, there was time where we were up in the high 80s. And you know, it was just, I learned drill. I bought my own landing party manual. In fact, I still have it. It's got stamped across it, Lance Corporal Bathurst. So the Gunny Cobb made me the drill master for the brig. And I taught the prisoners drill as a Lance Corporal. You know, on the 12-4 watch, there wasn't nothing for me in the turnkey to do. I was a post one. It was a turnkey post one, two, and three. The post one runs the compound. The turnkey sits up in a cage. And during the 12-4 watch at night, Corporal, forgot his name. Anyway, I'll think of it. He was a judo expert. And anyway, he and I would sit and work on MCI courses. During that time there at the brig, I completed 27 MCI courses, which is what got me corporal. When I went before the corporal's board, they were amazed at the number of MCI courses that I completed. And I also at that time determined I didn't want to be a radio operator anymore. I want to be a grunt. And so I started working my bolt once I got back to the States to get my MOS changed to 0300. And eventually it happened.
My guess
the only, is... The only way it happened was for me to volunteer for Vietnam.
Well, I want to talk about that. My guest is Jim Bathurst. For those of you who don't know Jim, first of all, shame on you. But he's gone from private to colonel in the Marine Corps in his long career. He's a writer, and we're going to talk about his writing here in a little bit. But I'm really curious about one of the things. I've been doing this show for almost 2 years now, Jim, and one of the things I've learned the most about is Vietnam. And Vietnam is a different war depending on what year you're there, where you're located, and this is very interesting. And so tell us about your Vietnam experience. So you obviously get your MOS changed. Who are you with, and what are you doing when you deploy to Vietnam?
I was, you know, I left, when I left Japan, I went to Lejeune. And I was in Delta Battery 2nd Battalion 10th Marines. I was the radio chief. Now, I'd been out of the radio field for 2 years. They got new radios while I was gone. But I was a senior corporal in the radio section, so I wound up as a radio chief. And again, I had another role model. Gunnery Sergeant Beachman, who... who taught me the M1 rifle when I went to boot camp. When I went to boot camp, DIs didn't teach a rifle. Special subject instructors from regiment taught the rifle. And Gunnery Sergeant Bigman is the one that that taught me the rifle. I check in there, and he's the battery gunnery sergeant. And he and I struck it off well. I don't know. They have a name for communicators. The Marine Corps did at the time. I don't think they use it anymore, but we were referred to as titless Pams.
I'm pretty sure that we don't use that one anymore.
Yeah. Oh, no. But the day I checked in,
right.
Gunny said, Brinkman was his name. Gunnery Sergeant Brinkman, the clerk tells me to pound on his hatch and do like you did in boot camp. I said, what? He goes, oh, yeah. So I go over, stand beside the hatch, pound three times. I heard somebody say, center the hatch, to the left face. He looks at me. I'm a corporal. I'm squared away. I'm looking good. So he said, enter. So I took two steps forward and entered. And so he opens up my record book and he goes, oh my God, another titless Bam. I never heard that term before, so I didn't know what that guy was talking about. And he said, just what we need, another communicator. So I assumed that's what he called communicators. And you're coming from a Marine barracks. Oh my God almighty, a spit and polish guy. I mean, he just berated me unbelievable, but somehow or another we hit it off, because when we'd have formation in the morning and then they'd break up to the platoons, and we'd do drill. And they let the NCOs do the drilling instead of the section chief or the platoon sergeant drilling. Well, shit, that was my bag. So I drilled. I drilled. And of course, the gunny's out there walking around. Well, the next thing you know, division drill competition comes up, and the gunny calls me in and says, I want you to, and you had to, every company or battery had to submit, the battery was going to drill, they had to submit a platoon to drill, and they had to submit a squad to drill. So he said, you're going to be my squad leader for the competition, drill competition for Delta Battery. Well, shit, I like that. He said, you can pick from anywhere in the battery. So I put out the word for volunteers. I got about 20 people to volunteer, but when they found out we were going to practice at 16:30, a lot of them fell out, but we practiced every day. Well, to make a long story short, we won the division squad competition. So all of a sudden, I'm Gunny Brinkman's pet. So one day he calls me in and says, the drill instructor board from Parris Island will be here next Tuesday, and I'm sending you down to appear before the board. A drill instructor? I mean, a drill instructor? You want me to be a drill instructor? Anyway, long story short, I went for the board. I passed it. I went down to DI school. I transferred down in March, 4 years from the day that I arrived at Parris Island. I'm arriving back again to be a DI, and I went to DI school. I came out second in DI school, so I wound up going to 2nd Battalion. I spent 2 years there, made sergeant. I had my last platoon as a... Right, as a senior drill instructor, and then I leave and go to Quantico.
Okay,
at Quantico.
Hold on, let me stop you there. A lot of problems, in the last 24 months at Parris Island. Give me your thoughts on that. How many times have you served on the drill field?
Once.
All right. Give me your thoughts on when you see that, with all your time in and around the Marine Corps. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, they need supervision. They really do. When you're taking in my day, I don't know what they are today, but when you're taking 75 kids and they're coming from all walks of life, you've got farmers, you've got guys from the hood, you've got guys, from the southerners that don't speak English, and I mean that jokingly. You got guys from South and East Philly, you're taking all these kids, 75 of them, and the And again, when I got to Parris Island, I'm impacted by leaders.
Right.
My second senior drill instructor was a guy by the name of Staff Sergeant, E5 Staff Sergeant, Staff Sergeant John F. Dunn. Still talk to him weekly on the internet. He's still alive, lives up in Rhode Island. He explained boot camp to me, because it was only my second platoon, the best I've ever heard it explained. He asked me, he said, "Pethers, can you take a bucket of muddy water, pour half of it out and add clear water and make clear water?" I said, "No." He said, can you pour out 3/4 of that bucket and add clear water and get clear water?" I said, "No." He said, "How are you going to get clear water?" I said, "Well, it's obvious. You got to empty the bucket, you got to wash it out, then you put clear water in it." He said, "That's what we do at Parris Island. We take this civilian scum and we reach inside his brain housing group and we wash out all that civilian stuff and we start filling it with Marine Corps stuff. That's what we do." And you know, I've used that explanation from then on. Hundreds of times. That's what Parris Island and San Diego do. Well, how you do that, some DIs, you know, depending on your temperament and everything else, I mean, there's a lot of times, you know, where a recruit really pisses you off. But you can't lay your hands on him. There's punishment that you can give out in the way of PT, and depending on what week they're in, you could use so many push-ups, so many side straddle hops, so many bends and thrusts and everything else. But that's the only tool you got. And, you know, some people do things that they shouldn't do. So there needs to be some supervision. And the supervision, I don't think, needs to be an officer. You know, when they were having problems initially at Parris Island, they, you know, with every 4 platoons, there's a series commander, an officer.
Right.
And then there's a gunnery sergeant who is the series gunnery sergeant.
Right.
And then each platoon has a senior drill instructor.
Right.
Who is supposed to be a staff NCO. And then he's got 2 juniors under him that are corporals and sergeants, or it could be a junior staff NCO. Oftentimes, we tend to, when we need supervision, we pile on more officers. Well, that's not where the leadership needs to be. The leadership needs to be at the senior drill instructor level. And the seniors that I worked for, when I got on the drill field, the drill field, this was 1962, the drill field was filled with what I call professional drill instructors. What they did was they'd go down and spend 2 years at Parris Island. Now you can extend for a third year, but you can't be a drill instructor. You can be a special subject instructor. For example, you could teach a rifle, you could teach judo, you could teach bayonet.
Right.
You can teach a confidence course, those things. You're up at regimental level, you still wear a campaign hat, you still get your pay, the $30 extra that they were given for being a DI, but you're not pushing recruits because they felt that 2 years was enough of putting up with that stuff. So
what are your thoughts about when you see the things that have happened? You know, you had a recruit, but you know, by the name of Siddiqui, he jumps off the third floor and kills himself. You have a trial, a gunnery sergeant just got sentenced to the brig for what, 14 years. He's got 4 daughters, you know, calling him a terrorist, you know, making him simulate slitting another Marine's throat, things like the very predatory behavior. And as you said, the answer seems to be more officer supervision.
Yeah, that's always the answer. But
it doesn't seem, I had General Jarvis Lynch on here, and who else did I have? Was it General Hoare who both said the same thing. They said, hey, look, as a general, you got to get out there and you got to know people. You got to be in the area.
Yeah.
And you got to supervise them. They got to know that you're coming around, that you'll look. How does the Marine Corps make this better? Is it just if you don't supervise, this stuff's going to happen, and that lesson is as old as, you know, all the enlistment documents vanishing from Tun Tavern the night of the first recruiting drive because nobody kept their eye on them? It's just supervision, period, that's it?
Well, you know, I'm during this conversation, I'm probably going to throw out a lot of cliches to you. I didn't invent them. I've never, I always bragged that, I never came up with anything. I always stole it from other people that I admired and respected. One of my things that I learned along the way is inspect what you expect. If you don't inspect what you expect, then don't expect it. Now, that supervision is what I'm talking about.
Right.
But that's just putting it in another way. So, and I think a lot of it has to do, the problems we have is a sign of the times. Our children out there today are not getting the best education in the world. Our education literally sucks. I mean, sucks. I have a daughter who works for a school. She's worked for him for 11 years. And when I sit down, it's not my daughter, it's my wife's daughter. She has three children from former marriage. I have two. But they're all my kids as far as I'm concerned. And when I sit and talk to her and she tells me about her day with seventh graders, and this is in a suburb of Chicago, a nice suburb, and she's got, in this seventh grade class she's got right now, she's got seven or eight kids that cannot say a sentence without the F word. She gets told F you at least two or three times a week. I think it's a sign of the times of the kids that we're rearing today. This kid that jumped off the third floor and hit the deck and died. Something was wrong with that kid. He should have never been in the Marine Corps. You know, and some of them squeak by the doctors at the Mets and everything else. I mean, that kid should never, somebody should have diagnosed that. Somebody should have realized this kid's brain housing group ain't working right.
Right.
And got him out of the Marine Corps before he did something like that. And as far as the gunnery sergeant, the guy's an idiot. I mean, the guy's an idiot. He's willing to jeopardize his career, his family, and everything else to do something like teaching the Marines how to slit somebody's throat. Are you kidding me?
Right.
You know, I mean, that's not in the curriculum. Stick with the curriculum. Teach what you're supposed to be teaching. Yeah, you teach them other things along the way, but there's a very strict curriculum for Parris Island in San Diego. And they just don't follow it.
So the
I learned how to be a DI under superb people. I mean, just let me finish the story about Dunn.
Sure.
Dunn spends 2 years in the drill field, then requests Okinawa. Now he goes to Okinawa for 13 months. What does that accomplish? First of all, it accomplishes his FMF tour. He was a grunt, and it accomplishes his overseas assignment. And what does he request when he's getting ready to leave Okinawa? The drill field. So he comes back to the drill field. It was Dunn's third time on the drill field. He went to the drill field, went to Okinawa, came back, drill field, went to Okinawa, came back, drill field. So, I mean, this is a guy that was tutoring me. This is a guy this guy knew more about training recruits than anybody that I ever met. And there were a whole slew of these guys there, what I called professional drill instructors.
Right.
And, you know, and Dunn, you know, gave me very strict orders at the very get-go. Don't ever let me see you lay a hand on a recruit in anger. That's not what we're here to do. See, I mean, that's the kind of supervision that is needed. Now I agree with Hoare, and I agree with I know them both. I mean, I love Jarvis Lynch like he's a brother.
Right.
And they're right. Supervision is a key to it. But you know, the series commander, and you know, they made an assistant series commander. They added another officer onto the thing so they could. When I was on the drill field, I never saw my series commander except at certain events. The series commander had to be there anytime there was physical contact or anything physical. So we had PT in the morning. We had PT, PT was the first session in the morning, and PT was the last session at night. The series commander had to be there. If we were bayonet training, series commander had to be there. Confidence course, series commander had to be there. Judo, series commander had to be there. Other than that, I never saw the series commander. But it was the staff NCOs that ruled. And they were good. For my 2 years on the drill field, from March of 62 to May of 64, I never heard of one court martial. Because we had supervision down where the rubber meets the road. The senior drill instructors. I mean, we have to be careful about who we assign as senior drill instructors. Because those are the people that are with that junior drill instructor and those recruits 24/7. Not the lieutenants. So I don't know. I think it's a combination of the sign of the times, of the people that were getting into the services, not just the Corps, but everybody else. You know, everybody, we all want to think that, you know, that, there are, you know, that every Marine is a great Marine. Well, you know, there's a lot of Cocker Spaniel Marines out there. And that's another term that Dunn taught me. You know, we'd see a drill instructor and he'd say he's a Cocker Spaniel Marine.
What does that mean?
What the hell is Cocker
Spaniel? Yeah, what does that mean?
And he says, did you ever own a Cocker Spaniel? I said, no. He said, they're a pretty dog, but they ain't worth a shit. So, you know, I mean, I grew up with staff NCOs that were, they were the epitome of what I thought a Marine should be. I mean, I consider myself fortunate that I never served under a bad staff NCO except Tom Company SDT in 1958. Now maybe it was just because I changed my MOS and became a grunt. And everywhere I went in the grunts, I had just great staff NCOs, great sergeants major, great gunnery sergeants, great first sergeants. You know, I mean, I'm assuming we still have them today. Well, put them where we need them. You know, every company has a CDI, a chief drill instructor, who I never, ever, ever saw. Gunnery Sergeant McLean, you know, I mean, if you wanted to see Gunnery Sergeant McLean, you had to go to his office because he never came out of that office. My series gunnery sergeant, I had several series gunnery sergeants, and they were all superb gunnery sergeants. They had all been drill instructors themselves. To be a series gunnery sergeant, you had to at least have several platoons under your belt as a senior drill instructor. I don't know what the criteria now is for becoming a senior drill instructor. I do know I have a grandson that graduated from boot camp in San Diego. We live in Illinois, so they ship everybody to San Diego. And I went out, him and his mother, as the same mother that is a school teacher, I flew out there for his graduation. And it seemed that every senior drill instructor I saw wearing a black belt was a sergeant. That's too young.
And not only are they sergeants, but they pick up that rank quicker as well.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then that's another thing that's changed in the Marine Corps. Is for those of us that are older, we're used to, you know, I see a staff sergeant and I think in my head, okay, I know where about he is in the Marine Corps. No, he's younger. He's younger.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's younger because we've fallen in line with everybody and their promotion rates. My guess is Jim Bathurst. And I've been pursuing this interview for a long time, and so he's been gracious enough to say he'd spend some time with us.
We are going to take a break. All right. I told you Gunnar a little bit under the weather, and I spoke with him yesterday, and he was on his way home, and I have not heard from him this morning. So that's normally a sign that Mike has shut it down. So, but you're going to be able to hear part two of Jim Bathurst. And, you know, like I said, the experience that he has in the Marine Corps that starts in 1958 is really unique. And as he says, every time I turned around, I had a role model, except for his initial assignment to a comm company. Every time I turned around, I had a great staff NCO that I looked up to that was a role model for me. And so his career is marked by those men who taught him. And interesting, his comments about who were assigning, you know, the professionals that he met on the drill field. And when you're talking about the early 60s, and he's getting told never to lay your hands on a recruit in anger, right? And so these guys were professionals. And again, Ribbon Creek, I should play that interview again. John Stevens had on a while ago with the constant references to Ribbon Creek after what happened in Paris Island here most recently. I did a little exploration with that. If you've never heard it, the two interviews are awesome. And he explains what happened at Ribbon Creek. So I should probably play that here in the upcoming not too distant future. So we're going to take a quick break. You'll hear part two from Jim Bathurst. Mike is under the weather, so you won't hear from him today. And we continue on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs at allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs at allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do. And I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsouthfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.